From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. 75 years ago today, Prohibition came to a close. The 13-year experiment in going dry never worked terribly well, especially in San Francisco, which managed to keep the drinks flowing throughout the 1920s and early 1930s. This morning on Forum, we'll hear about what San Francisco was like during Prohibition, where you can find reminders of that time today, and how San Franciscans are continuing to do their part to maintain the tradition of speaking easy and carrying a big drink. Remembering Prohibition, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson.
The decisive vote of the 36th state against Prohibition is happy news for the grain raisers of the United States and for many others throughout the land. With an eye on December 5th, work is being rushed in distilleries and bottling works. Thousands are being called back to work in plants of allied industries. At least 500,000 new jobs are predicted as the result of repeal. From keg and barrel factories, perhaps the most closely allied line, immediate benefits from repeal extend into almost every line of business and commerce. However, everyone's not waiting until December 15th. The lid is off in many places, with the downfall of Prohibition being celebrated in real old-time hilarity. Yes, and by the renewal of old acquaintances. Hotels and nightclubs report a real pre-war spirit among those revelers. Boy!
An excerpt from a 1933 Universal newsreel describing what it was like when Prohibition came to a close. That date was 75 years ago today, December the 5th, 1933. And it seems only fitting that after spending our last hour talking about hard times and the credit card crunch, that we're going to spend our second hour this morning on Forum talking about the return of alcohol, this being the 75th anniversary of the end of Prohibition. Though, if truth be told, alcohol never really left the American scene, particularly in San Francisco. As writer Nick Adamick put it in the San Francisco Chronicle recently, for a dry era, San Francisco was always wet. Why is that the case? Well, in part it's because San Franciscans weren't keen on legislating morality. And there were also plenty of speakeasies here in the Bay Area, the character of which are maintained by a number of local watering holes still today. There were plenty of colorful characters, too, and we'll talk about that some over the course of this hour, including even a few who tried to enforce Prohibition, like an ambitious young Alameda County district attorney named Earl Warren, who would later create a much different legacy as Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. So today, in the second hour of Forum, we're going to remember Prohibition and what it was like when Prohibition came to a close, that curious time in American history that we mark 75 years ago today. Joining us to talk about it, Dick Boyd. He's author of Broadway North Beach, The Golden Years, A Saloon Keeper's Tale. He also owned a bar in the North Beach vicinity in the 1960s. Mr. Boyd, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Happy to have you with us. Joining us as well by telephone this morning, Charles Fracchia. He's founder and president emeritus of the San Francisco Museum and Historical Society and author of Fire and Gold, The San Francisco Story. Charles Fracchia, good morning.
Good morning to you, Dave.
And joining us as well, also by phone, is James Smith. He is the author of San Francisco's Lost Landmarks. James Smith, happy to have you join us.
Good morning, and thank you.
Well, we're pleased all of you could be here. Let's talk first about what it was like during that time from what you've read and written about. Dick Boyd, sort of set the scene for us, if you can. We heard something from that newsreel. You could hear the sort of joyous quality of the newscaster's voice. Sketch out for us what San Francisco was like in December of 1933, as you've written and read about that time.
Well, as I understand, they couldn't get legal booze right away, whether the breweries couldn't provide it or whatever, but there was enough around. I mean the legal booze. So there was enough illegal booze around that they could have some great celebrations. But I'm sure, based on the fact that San Franciscans had voted against having – 83% voted against having prohibition. So – and they never stopped drinking the whole time anyway. But So it was a wild time, no doubt, you know. Of course, I wasn't there, but that's just from people I've talked to. And then I had my place on Broadway in the back end. It was 546 Broadway and by Romolo Alley. And in the back, there was these huge rooms that were walled over in the front. And I was told that they were where they stored booze to get to when they delivered it, they put it, they had to have a distribution point, and that was what it was. But I'm sure that you can speak with Charles and some others can set the scene as well.
Dick Boyd, author of Broadway North Beach, The Golden Years, The Saloon Keeper's Tale. Charles, sketch out for us the rest of us, because as Dick suggests, there are plenty of reminders and remnants that you can find all around San Francisco of what the era of Prohibition was like.
Well, the era of Prohibition was certainly was not a deprivation of alcohol for San Franciscans. As Dick pointed out, the overwhelming majority of San Francisco voted against Prohibition. That was not matched by the population in other parts of the state, particularly Los Angeles, which had a totally different demographics than San Francisco, and voted for Prohibition.
Spell out a little bit more about that, if you would, Charles Farkey,
sure.
About that demographic difference and why that made San Francisco such a different place.
Well, you know, from the time of the Gold Rush, San Francisco's had, of all the cities in the United States, has had either the top or the one of the top three foreign-born residencies. So you had Europeans from Italy. You had the Irish. You had all sorts of people who never had no cultural connections with not drinking. Whereas in Los Angeles, you had a largely Native American. I don't mean Indian, but people who had long generations from the Midwest or the South, and they brought with them to Los Angeles that very puritanical aspect. So this is really, in a sense, a tale of two cities, very, very, very different. So when Prohibition passed, as I said, as Dick pointed out, 83% of these citizens voted no. They basically, business as usual. There was no sense that we have to enforce this. The Irish had been traditionally throughout the United States against Prohibition. They dominated the courts, they dominated the civil service, dominated the police department, and you can imagine how much, you know, support you're going to get for Prohibition in that situation.
Well, and even the Board of Supervisors, as I was reading in the mid-1920s, passed a resolution saying that the police shouldn't enforce it. So even at all levels of government, there wasn't exactly enthusiasm for Prohibition.
Exactly. And so that allowed a widespread non-recognition of the law. You had smuggling going on in San Mateo County, where ships would come in and smuggle in booze from abroad. You had numerous bootleggers throughout the Bay Area, particularly in San Francisco and San Mateo counties, providing all the liquor you'd want. And as I said, you had a population that both drank and supported drinking.
Charles Farkey, founder and president emeritus of the San Francisco Museum and Historical Society and author of Fire and Gold, The San Francisco Story. James Smith is joining us this hour as well to talk about those times. He's the author of San Francisco's Lost Landmarks. In terms of landmarks that still bear a connection to that time, James Smith, Dick Boyd was saying at the back of the tavern that he owned, there were rooms that might have been used during Prohibition. Walk us through some of the spots where you still can find what Prohibition looked like.
So there are still places. The Sir Francis Drake actually has a Prohibition tour where they'll take you through their storage room, which resides between the mezzanine and the second floor. It takes a special key in the elevator to get to that room where they actually stored their alcohol. The hotel was built during Prohibition, and they specifically built that in to avoid not being able to have alcohol. They also had cubbies in the doors where a bellboy could pop a bottle of whiskey in or a beer or something for a patron. The bellboy would close the door. There was another door on the inside where the person could open it up and take it, so neither could see who delivered it or who took it, so you couldn't testify against each other. The Chancellor Hotel, the mezzanine was the bar at that time. It was a perfect place for a lookout, and they actually had a speakeasy up there that was operating all the time, never got busted.
And define the word speakeasy, if you would, please, for those who aren't really familiar with its derivation. How did that come about, and what did it mean?
Well, the term speakeasy came about from the idea of just speakeasy. In other words, don't tell everyone where it is, what it is. It was a place that, the idea was as long as you kept your booze under the table, everyone looked the other way. So Mayor Sonny Jim Rolfe had a very open attitude of, we will not support prohibition in this town. Chief Daniel O'Brien basically controlled all of the crime in the city, and basically, they managed it. They didn't shut it down. They did a survey and found that the city had 1,492 locations where alcohol was served.
1,492?
In the city of San Francisco, and this was in 1922. So nothing was shut down. They purposely did not shut it down. But again, you had to keep it low-key. The feds were very frustrated because the local people wouldn't support it. District Attorney Matthew Brady would not prosecute bootleggers in those cases where he actually had to take them to court because someone did. The fines were nothing more than a slap on the hand.
In a sense, Dick Boyd, it sounds like in lots of ways San Francisco really hasn't changed very much, that it's a city that doesn't like to legislate morality and where there is a sort of anything-goes kind of attitude, right?
Yeah, I would have to go along with that. But let me go back to what Charles was saying. They voted against it. The vote was in 1914. That was before women could vote. Mm. And so it was women that was largely responsible.
The Christian Temperance Union.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And I got a great story that I just got from a guy down in Castro, the Holy Redeemer's Church. There was and this was Irish ladies, wives of alcoholics. During a prohibition, they formed a group, and they called it the Order of the Sacred Thirst. And one priest, they would go down, and there was 9 bars at least along Castro, where the Castro Theater is, that block there. And they would kneel. Well, they would first sing songs, and then they'd kneel down and pray. And the priest would go in and get a hold, try to find the husband of those that were there and get whatever money was left for the rent or whatever, because drinking was a serious problem with the Irish, and the poor women were the ones that had to do all the shopping and, the rest of it.
And so, this was the Order of the Sacred Thirst?
Order of the Sacred Thirst, it was called, yeah.
That's a great name.
Yeah, but anyway, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask Charles Frackie then, and then James Smith, tune in this too, because it sounds like Dick Boyd is saying that if women had been empowered a bit more, if there had been their ability to vote, that things might have been a bit different. Charles Smith?
Yeah,
James Smith, sorry.
Where are we going here?
Yeah.
All right, this is Charles Frackie. I must say I kind of doubt that, in the sense that where there were heavy Irish agglomerations – around the country, New York, Boston, and so forth. These are really fringe movements. I think that given if women had the right to vote, I still think it would have been maybe not as overwhelming, but still would have been against prohibition.
And actually, Charles Frackie, didn't prohibition in some ways invite women into the drinking participation, because there was a sort of change in mores, in a sense?
Exactly. It became very fashionable for women to join men. Before this, it was drinking was basically a man's thing out in bars. It was a social aspect. After Prohibition, women would join the men in various social outings in bars or, entertainment spots and so forth. So, yeah, it was a big factor. Yeah, and I agree with Dick that, certainly alcoholism was a big problem among the Irish. But I still think this is a fringe operation that that would not have been had a wide popular support.
James Smith, what about the role of gangsters in all of this? We associate that time, of course, with gangsters in Chicago in particular. But from what I understand, that didn't really happen here, that the delivery and smuggling of booze and running illegal drinking places was not really something that was controlled by gangsters. Why was that different here?
That was controlled by the police. They
were the gangsters.
They weren't the gangsters, but they took in a lot of extra money for the Widows and Orphans Union and whatnot. The reason was that if you wanted to do business in San Francisco, you literally had to sign up with the police. I mean, they would take their protection money, and they limited what was going on. So that's why they were able to do a survey. They knew how many were out there because they were taking payments from them. Somebody came in from the mob, they would literally tell them, gee, have a good time today and be on the train to Los Angeles tomorrow. It was that kind of a thing. The police ran a very they had tight control over everything from the brothels to the speakeasies, the hotels, every place that served liquor. And just about every place did serve liquor. It was openly done at the Palace Hotel, where if you went there for dinner and ordered flowers for your date, the flowers would come with a bottle of whiskey in the box.
Did you have to know what flowers to order, James Smith? Was there a special code that allowed you to get a drink?
I think you had to – basically, you had to know what it was. It was like with any other speakeasy. You had to be familiar with the place. And so usually you'd be introduced by a friend or someone else that would say, here's how you do it. But, I mean, every place had something. There's still the remnants of the speakeasy in the basement of the St. Francis Hotel. I've been down there. It was a huge bar. And actually the brass rail is still left from that, runs about 18, 20 foot. And that was an open secret. That's the place, by the way, where the famous Fatty Arbuckle party was held, where later on he was charged with murder three times.
Let's talk a little about what people actually drank during that time. We have always heard the expression bathtub gin. Is that really what people wanted to, what people actually consumed, Dick Boyd? And you wanted to add something in to what James Smith was also saying.
Yeah, Jim is right in what he's saying. But as North Beach was a little bit different, they were Italian, Irish. The police force was the police department was mostly Irish. North Beach was mostly Italian. And there was a bunch of naughty boys from Philadelphia, Chicago, and New York that came out to San Francisco, and Sicilian to be exact, and they invaded out there and they took over control. It was a guy named Joe Parenti that brought the booze in, and he partnered up with Madden. He brought some booze into Sausalito, and the mayor over there was Herbert Madden. He partnered up with him, but they also delivered, as I think Charles mentioned earlier, Princeton Beach, Half Moon Bay, Pescadero, and the like. But anyway, he got bumped off. And when he got bumped off, and he was operating out of Canada, when he got bumped off, these Sicilians from back east came in, and they took it over, and they had incredible nicknames. The Don Juan of North Beach, Gennaro the Magnificent, the Strong Man of the Sicilians, King of North Beach Crips, Al Capone of the West. And they had power struggles out there after Parenti got knocked off. And so the police chief at the time was... what the heck's his name?
O'Brien, I think, wasn't it?
No, I got it here somewhere. Anyway, he went out and he had he went all out to close him down, and of course he succeeded. His name was William Quinn. William Quinn was the chief at that time, and he shut him down and ran him out. And after the end of prohibition with the Volstead Act, only thing that was left was gambling. There were three racetracks out here, and there were slot machines in San Mateo and things like that. So there was things to be for naughty boys to get involved in, and they did for a while. But anyway, back to your question.
Well, I do want to come back to the question of also the smuggling that was done along the San Mateo coast, because that's an interesting story in and of itself. But I still want to know what people actually drank. I mean, was there really such a thing as bathtub gin, Dick Boyd?
Sure, there was gin, and it was made in the bathtubs by a lot of people wherever. They knew how to make booze way back, you know, in B.C., you know, they knew how to make booze, and they made beer. The Irish made beer at home, and I guess, and of course, the Italians made a lot of wine in their places in North Beach, and up in Sonoma and places like that. And then they brought it in.
And Charles Frakey, what would you add about what people actually consumed, and whether or not the Prohibition era took a toll on the quality of what people drank?
Well, there's no doubt about it. That it took a toll on the quality. The drinks were largely gin and bourbon. Scotch didn't catch on until after Prohibition. So those are the two principal drinks. And the idea of bathtub gin, as Dick pointed out, is people did actually make maybe not in enormous quantities, but it was easy enough to. My father, for example, was approached by fellow townmate from Italy to go into this bootlegging business. My father said, I could have made a lot of money, but I was scared in those days.
Hmm.
And, you know, you just basically you bought the formula from them and you added the whatever you added and so forth on the line. And, you know, you can just start distributing quarts of alcohol. But Dave, I want to just weigh in just a little bit more about the conversation on gangsters. One of the things I've always maintained is that one of the reasons San Francisco never really had much of a presence of gangsters. You know, you see all these movies on Chicago or New York or even St. Louis, Detroit, and so forth. And my contention is that the basic premise that is that the mafia never got really a hold in San Francisco as it did in the cities of the East and in Midwest.
That's
and great. The reason that primarily is that the Eastern and Midwestern cities were largely Sicilian, which from whence the mafia actually comes, whereas San Francisco is dominated by Northern Italians. So you never had those gangs here that were able to get the tremendous amount of money and muscle to totally pay off the courts and the police and so forth. So you never had the Valentine's Day massacres and the whole tremendous gang-riddenness of the cities of the East and Midwest.
Charles Fracchia, the founder and president emeritus of the San Francisco Museum and Historical Society, also the author of Fire and Gold, The San Francisco Story. A couple of you have touched on this question of how booze was smuggled in along the San Mateo coast in particular. James Smith, tell us about that a little bit. How did that take place? What sort of risk was involved? What was the scene like on those nights when smuggling took place?
Well, there were two ways of smuggling liquor in. One was by ship, and the other was by car or truck up and down the coast. By ship, it would come down from Vancouver, usually with good Canadian booze, and that would come down, staying outside the 3-mile limit, and then they would have fast boats that would run out there, pick up the liquor, and either bring it in someplace around Half Moon Bay along the coast there, or they'd actually bring it into the bay, and the feds didn't have boats fast enough to catch them, and they would literally run that stuff under the piers and hang it under the piers to be pulled up later. As far as the feds got so silly at one point, they actually bought a submarine to try and deal with this stuff, which I think was just a publicity stunt. But they had a hard time making inroads until the feds actually got fast boats, and then they started. At least keeping them out of the bay.
We have to take a break, but there's a restaurant in Moss Beach called The Distillery that goes back to that time, right, where some of that booze was smuggled in and served. That's an old speakeasy from that era?
I believe it is. I haven't studied that one, so I haven't researched it, but I've read a few newspaper articles that certainly talked about Moss Beach as a landing spot.
James Smith, the author of San Francisco's Lost Landmarks. We're going to keep talking about Prohibition. When we come back, we'll also talk about some of what's going on today in San Francisco to celebrate the end of Prohibition, which took place 75 years ago today, December the 5th, 1933. We'll hear more from James Smith, the author of San Francisco's Lost Landmarks. Dick Boyd, author of Broadway North Beach, The Golden Years, A Saloon Keeper's Tales, and Charles Fracchia, author of Fire and Gold, The San Francisco Story. And you can call in with your thoughts and remembrances as well. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email us your bathtub gin recipes at forum@kqed.org.
Drink too much. Yes, you drink too much. You can't do nothing 'cause you drink too much.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. We're talking this hour about the repeal of Prohibition, which took place 75 years ago today, December the 5th, 1933. Allegedly, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the 21st Amendment, he said, quote, "I believe this would be a good time for a beer." Don't know if that's really true or not, but it makes for a good story. We're joined by some other good storytellers this hour. James Smith, the author of San Francisco's Lost Landmarks. Dick Boyd, author of Broadway North Beach, The Golden Years, A Saloon Keeper's Tale. And Charles Fracchia, the founder and president emeritus of the San Francisco Museum and Historical Society, also the author of Fire and Gold, The San Francisco Story. We're joined on the line now, though, by Brian Sheehy, who is owner of Bourbon and Branch, which is a San Francisco bar that maintains some of the speakeasy tradition. Happy 75th anniversary, Brian Sheehy.
Thanks very much. It's a very historic day for us at Bourbon and Branch, indeed.
We're happy to have you with us. Tell us a little bit about your restaurant, because you really do maintain some of the speakeasy traditions, starting with the fact that you have to know something special in order to get in through the front door.
Absolutely. Well, the first point about Bourbon and Branch is it's not a restaurant. We serve only the finest of libations with tableside service. But in order to get in there, you're not going to find our address anywhere. You have to make a reservation, and when you make that reservation, you'll get a confirmation from us with a password, and that password changes daily. So when you arrive at Bourbon and Branch, you have to hand over that password before we grant you access.
And then when you do get granted access, there's also you have a few other things that make the locale feel like what it once was, right? There's a special passageway you go through.
It's like a maze inside Bourbon and Branch. There's been a bar at this location on Jones Street since 1867, and the local historian officer, James Jarvis, he has completed the entire history of this space. And during Prohibition, it was two different venues. For the first 2 years, it operated as a soft drinks parlor by a guy called Frank Ipswich. And then a gentleman, an Irishman from Vancouver, moved down here. He was involved in the bootlegging business. And he came ashore, and he loved San Francisco, and he ended up buying the business from Frank Ipswich. And so for the remainder of Prohibition, all the way to 1935, actually, J.J. Russell operated a cigar shop here. So the guests of the time would come inside the cigar shop, and if they ordered the correct brand of cigar, then the trapdoor would open. One of many trapdoors would open, and they would be escorted to the bar in the basement, which had a full complement of beverage from around the world.
Brian Sheehy.
Even to this day, there are 5 exits from the basement of Bourbon and Branch, and the original speakeasy is still there. You can still see it to this day.
Brian Sheehy, the owner of Bourbon and Branch, which is a San Francisco bar that maintains some of the speakeasy tradition, including apparently cell phones. Didn't know that those went back to 1933. Tell us how you're going to honor the day today. Are you going to offer special drinks, bathtub gin and whatnot?
I'm afraid no bathtub gin for us. I'd have to disagree with some of the guys there. The quality of beverage in San Francisco was probably the best you could get anywhere in the country during Prohibition. So we're taking a leaf out of Jerry Thomas's book, How to Mix Drinks, and we have a special repeal menu here today. So there's going to be, in addition to the many other cocktails that we offer, we're going to have drinks that came from pre-Prohibition, during Prohibition, and immediately after Prohibition.
Brian Sheehy, the owner of Bourbon and Branch in San Francisco. Thanks for chiming in this morning. Happy 75th anniversary of Prohibition.
Thanks very much. Take care.
There are also a number of other establishments around the city that are going to be honoring the repeal of Prohibition today. There's also going to be a parade, by the way, starting down at the Ferry Building in San Francisco and going up Market Street in honor of the 21st Amendment. That starts between 3:30 and 4 this afternoon. There's a fun article by Carl Nolte in this morning's San Francisco Chronicle if you want to learn more, both about the history of Prohibition in the city, but also some of the events that are taking place today. We're joined now as well by Warren Hinkle. He's the publisher of Argonaut Magazine and a longtime, of course, writer about the all things San Francisco. Is this a happy day for you, Mr. Hinkle?
Anything in the morning is particularly unhappy.
But you made it here in honor of this particular day?
Barely. Jeez, I can see why it's a bad day.
Warren Hinkle joining us along with James Smith, Dick Boyd, and Charles Fracchia as we talk about what San Francisco was like during that time. What's your favorite Prohibition story, Warren Hinkle, about that time?
Well, some of us, of course, Fracchia is older than King Tut, but some of us are old enough to have the privilege of knowing when we were growing up, kids in college and things, drinking illegally in their joints, some of the great old saloon keepers who were open during Prohibition, such as Shanty Malone, who's had many different locations in town, and Cookie Pichetti, who was a runner as a kid, and quite a few of those guys. Shanty is one of the famous old-time San Francisco saloon keepers. He was going well into the 60s, 1960s, that is. And he had a joint, he called it a pickup and run joint. He'd get raided once in a while, and he'd send a guy around. They'd find an apartment house, a rooming house or something, and they'd rent a room for the evening. And he'd go out, and he had a couple of barrels, and he had a board, and he had a couple of guys help him. He told me the story many times, haul the barrels and the plank of wood up to the rented room. And he'd be in business, except, of course, he didn't have any booze because he didn't have any money. But the word went out in the street really fast. Shanty's operating at so-and-so in Clay Street.
So it was sort of a traveling roadshow? I mean, this was something
that
moved
from place
to place?
Yeah, he just set up in different places all the time. And word got around fast that he was in operation. So he'd tell me sometimes when I was really short, didn't have any dough at all, the first guy'd come in, he looked fairly prosperous, and I'd say to him, how much you intend to drink today? How much you intend to drink? The guy said, well, I don't know. Well, come on, you must know. How much you intend to drink? Well, 3-4 drinks, maybe 5, Shanty said. Well, yeah, maybe 5. He says, great. They're $2 a piece in here. Give me $10. And he'd take $10 from the guy and run out and get a bottle, come back, put the bottle on the plank, and he was in business.
The entrepreneurial spirit of San Francisco, going back clearly all the way to the 1920s. Let's take some of your calls this hour, your questions and thoughts and remembrances about that time, if you go back that far, or what you'd like to know about what San Francisco was like in the 1920s. Dave joins us first in Napa Valley this morning. That's a good place to call from on this celebration of the end of Prohibition. Dave, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. It is just about perfect, and it's a gorgeous day. I'm driving up, but I'm being nice and safe on my Bluetooth. It was a funny segue. You mentioned the entrepreneurial spirit during Prohibition. I'm always amazed when I read the histories of the wineries in the Napa Valley, because they've actually been around for a very long time, and how they survived during Prohibition. And as you read these histories, they always say, well, during Prohibition, they survived by making quote-unquote, sacramental wine. And it's amazing how many wineries stayed afloat, but no pun intended, by making sacramental wine. So I guess there were a ton of priests drinking very heavily during Prohibition. I'd be really interested in hearing your guests' added tales about the wine country during Prohibition, if there are any.
All right, Dave, thanks for the call. We talked a little earlier about what Dick Boyd called the Order of the Sacred Thirst, which is a name I'm always going to remember. But Charles Fracchia, can you add into anything about the way in which the Catholic Church kept winemaking business busy during Prohibition?
Well, it wasn't the Catholic Church so much, except for the fact there was a ruse used by the wineries to grow more grapes and make some wine under the rubric of sacramental wines used, obviously, in the Mass. My father used to always laugh about that because there must have been an enormous explosion of piety during the during the Prohibition period that all these Masses began to. And it's indeed true that was one of the ruses by which the wineries, largely owned by Italians, were able to crank out additional amounts of wine. And also there was a whole situation you could make a certain amount of wine for home consumption, and that, let's say, it was 50 gallons. I forgot exactly what it was now, and that was, you know, they would make 200 gallons and sell it. So wine, we talk about the liquors, you know, gin and bourbon and so forth, but wine was also a big factor in San Francisco and Prohibition.
Nancy in San Mateo County perhaps knows something about smuggling. I don't know. Nancy, go ahead.
Until about 3 years ago, there used to be a small barn at the corner of Jefferson and Lakeview Way in unincorporated San Mateo County. It's now known as Emerald Hills. And my neighbor across the street told me that when she was a girl, she would ride her horse up from Redwood City up to that barn, which was on the other side of the pond, and she would put the sugar in the still on a regular basis because her family knew that the feds wouldn't arrest a young girl if she was putting sugar in the still.
So we not only have sacramental mass to thank, we have children on horseback for maintaining alcohol production during Prohibition. Nancy, thanks. Thanks for the call and the story. Warren Hinkle, go ahead.
Yeah, she's right on. And it wasn't just, of course, the uplands in San Mateo County. A couple of Dashiell Hammett's novels, he has quite a bit, and a lot of his settings are around Half Moon Bay, where, of course, a lot of the boats would come in with booze. And there was a big place called Paradise Cove over in Marin County, which was only accessible by boat. They bring booze in by boat and leave, and other guys go in by boat and grab it. But there's one thing overall that you should look at Prohibition, I think, in the context of, and that's San Francisco law enforcement, which was different than almost any law enforcement in the United States. And Prohibition was therefore different in San Francisco. It was different because there was no mob in San Francisco. It wasn't because the police were particularly efficient or pious. It was because the police wanted the business themselves. And they ran all the rackets and the rackets that were allowed. And geez, I remember interviewing Mickey Cohen, the old famous mobster, years back, and he told me about several trips up to San Francisco where the cops somehow knew he was coming. They'd meet him at the train station. He'd be very polite. Where are you staying? The Fairmont? Great, you have a good time. We got you on the 10 o'clock back to L.A. Mm-hmm. Stay in town one day.
Well, that
they
echoes,
ran the whole thing.
That's what echoes what I think you were saying before, right, James Smith, that it was the police who really kept control of all of this.
That's exactly it. I mean, the San Francisco police were in control of the city. They knew they couldn't legislate that stuff out, so rather than try and do away with it, they just controlled it.
Here's a question from Tom, and James Smith, perhaps you know the answer to this. He writes, I know a hidden remnant of the Prohibition era right under Market Street. A few years ago, I was given the opportunity to explore the former speakeasy below the Warfield Theater. The room was actually located directly below Market Street and connected to the building across the street. The installation of Bart and Muni under that split the room in two and rendered it structurally unsound. What remains include fantastic murals, beautiful furniture, amazing light fixtures. Do you know about that one, James Smith?
I do. The Warfield speakeasy was well known, and there were a number of speakeasies that had tunnels going under the street. The York Hotel, the Plush Room, was actually starting out as one of the top speakeasies in the city. And to get to the Plush Room, you didn't go through the York Hotel. There was no way down there. You went to a room across the, a door across the street. You went under the street and up into the Plush Room where they had great entertainment and, absolutely top-notch booze.
Is there a way, James Smith, where people can find these things? We were talking earlier about that the Sir Francis Drake has a Prohibition tour, but is there a way you can go around the city or the San Mateo or Marin coasts and find out about all these places?
It's possible. Some of these places, like Slide, which is one of the new clubs in the city, was put in the same place as old Coffee Dan's, which was also a speakeasy. The way you get into it is via Slide, which is the same way you used to get into to Coffee Dan's. I was actually there, and if you make arrangements with folks, you can get in and see the old rooms and such. Of course, it's pretty run down now in the back, but Slide itself is a gorgeous club. And again, that's a modern speakeasy.
James Smith, one of our guests this hour. He's the author of San Francisco Lost Landmarks. I'm going to go to another call, James, but did you want to add one more thing?
Yeah, I'd say if you go to the Chancellor Hotel and check with one of the personnel there, if the mezzanine's not busy, you can maybe get a tour of the mezzanine, and it's a great place to stop.
All right, Chancellor Hotel here in the city. Let's go to our next caller, whose name, I'm afraid, has dropped off my screen, but apparently it's a story about bail bondsmen. Hank, I guess. Hank, go ahead.
Hank in Oakland. I wanted to talk about what was called the greatest Prohibition coup on the Pacific Coast in 1923 when Pete McDonough and his brother Tom and nephew Harry were busted for selling 5 gallons of liquor to a fed. The remarkable thing about it is that after the conviction, Pete was almost by President Coolidge almost pardoned him because a letter from the governor, three congressmen, the mayor, Rolfe, police commissioner, judges of the appellate court, 11 superior court judges, all the justices of the peace, city clerk, auditor, recorder, all wrote letters to Coolidge asking that they pardon the great Pete McDonough, who was a bail bondsman, ran office for 40 years on Kearney and Clay.
Hank, thanks. Thanks for the call and the observation. There are some
and
great...
And Kearney and Clay became a saloon.
It was the
their
corner.
Their old office.
It was called the corner. His father opened it as a bar, and they were told said to have invented the bail bonding business, so they converted it from a saloon into a bail bonds house. It was a block from the old Hall of Justice.
Hank. Yeah, their old driver, a guy named Cookie Pichetti, who was a longtime friend of mine.
I love these names. There should
Cookie Pichetti's. It was called the Blue Star Cafe, and that was the McDonough's bail bond place until they finally got in trouble with grand juries way down the line in the late 30s or so, or into the 40s. And he was a loyal driver, so when they were shutting down, they gave him the place as a bar. They always had licenses laying around, and he was in the booze business thereafter.
Warren Hinkle joining us this hour, talking about all these great names, Cookie Pichetti, The Order of the Sacred Thirst. There's a book, I think, that could be done just on the names from the 1920s. My favorite story that I read about in terms of the pursuit of justice during this was perhaps you know of the story, James Smith or Charles Fracchia, that there was a jury in Los Angeles who was trying a bootlegging case, and the jury drank the evidence.
That's true, but I think that was in San Francisco.
Oh, I should have known.
Yeah. Los Angeles, you couldn't bear to drink that stuff. They had a lot of denatured alcohol and stuff they were working with there, whereas, in fact, as Brian mentioned, we had the best of the best up here.
Dick Boyd.
Well, and as Jim mentioned earlier, I believe, about the feds getting involved, a friend of mine, John O'Shea, was a policeman in the city, and his uncle had a dump out on Army Street, which is now whatever it is, Cesar Chavez, and the feds came in with a truck full of booze they'd confiscated from a driver somewhere, and they said, "Welcome, partner," and they put him in the booze business, and there was no saying no, you know. And then, interesting, speaking about drivers, Henry Dolger, who developed, as we should know, all about the Sunset and the Westlake, he was a driver along with Joe Vanessi from Vanessi's Restaurant. I think most people probably, you know a little bit about that.
Chuck in Berkeley has our next call this morning. Chuck, go ahead.
Hey, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Listen, I just wonder if you guys could validate a story that I heard about the Valhalla in Sausalito, Sally Stanford. It sort of was a famous house of prostitution, among other things. But the story that I got was that on low tide, they would bring the booze in by boat and bury it in the sand underneath the hotel that was actually built out on a pier. And so they could go down there at low tide when the water was out and dig up the booze. And when the tide was high, obviously, the feds could never figure out where the booze was. I was just wondering if there's some validity to that story that I heard, and I'd be happy to take my answer off the air.
Chuck,
if
thanks.
That isn't true, it should be.
No, that is in fact true. And I can't tell you where I read it, but I read the same story. I think Sally Stanford told about it in her book. But that's true.
Couple of emails coming in. Ted wants to remind us that although Prohibition had its problems, it's important to remember that there were fewer alcoholics and related diseases to that time. People may need their vices, but we should also not forget the trade-offs. So,
correction,
Ted,
there were fewer reported alcoholics.
And here's
a lot,
one.
A lot more poisonings, though.
More poisonings. True. Eric writes in, there was a brewery, Pabst maybe, in South of Market in San Francisco. What happened to pre-Prohibition breweries in San Francisco? It's true. It's one of the things, I can't remember the statistics, but there were thousands and thousands of breweries in the United States before 1920. Were there breweries here that went out of business and never to return?
Yeah, but then most of them came back and were driven out of business in the 50s and 60s.
I worked at Regal Pale Brewery. There was Acme Brewery. There was Hams. It was a beautiful
Hams
building.
Right near here, actually.
Yeah, you could go
away.
Up and Hams Brew Sky Room or whatever. There was a number of breweries around. They're still going. One Anchor Steam Beer is still going.
The last one.
Joe joins us next, listening on our satellite network in New Orleans, a place not unlike San Francisco in some ways when it comes to the propensity to keep alcohol flowing. Joe, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I really enjoy listening to your show.
Good.
My dad had he was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and he knew a pharmacist that would get doctors to write prescriptions for medicinal whiskey. And he would buy it from the pharmacist. It came in pints. I've seen one. It said for medicinal purposes only. It was John Paul Jones was the brand name. And it was bottled in bond. It was 100 proof bourbon. And it was made by a distillery in Indiana.
Joe, thanks for the call and the observation. So we now have sacramental wine. We have priests who are responsible. Now we have physicians who are doing this for only medicinal purposes.
And don't forget drugstores.
Warren Henkel. Oh, pharmacists were in that business, too?
Oh, yeah, the Puccinelli brothers were famous.
Puccinelli's?
Yeah. They were in North Beach, and they famously, you could take care of a gunshot if you went into the pharmacy, or you could get a shot or a bottle of whiskey. Either way, you could get a shot.
Joe in Lake County has our next call or observation or good story. Joe, go ahead.
Hi. From what I hear, prohibition was put into effect to stop alcohol being used as a fuel. In the very beginning of cars, Ford ran the Model T and the Model A to both run on alcohol and oil. Can you hear me well?
Joe, we're having trouble with your we're having trouble with your connection, but I think we got the gist of the call. Charles Fracchia, can you comment on that? Was part of the drive for prohibition that people didn't want the early auto manufacturers didn't want alcohol used in cars?
There's an Italian expression, "Se non è vero è ben trovato," which translates as, "If it's not true, it's still a good story." but that doesn't ring true to me.
We're going to take a break from our calls because we're having a couple of phone issues. So we'll ask our callers to stay with us, keep trying to call in as we sort that out and continue our conversation about that time. What would you like people to remember, Dick Boyd, about that era that's worth remembering on this 75th anniversary?
Well, for me, the whole flapper era and all that stuff from the 20s was just exciting. I remember my mom telling me, she was born in 1897, and I remember her telling me about my dad taking her to these places, and she was from the little town of Yuba City, and it was like the greatest thing since canned peaches for her to go to those places. You could see her eyes light up when she talked about it. When you're telling your son about it, you know that it had to be special. But that's what it is to me. It was just a special time, you know. And of course, I don't know what we proved, except you can't legislate morality. But in any event, I remember the dancing girls Joe sent me, and the little door would open, you know, and that's what I remember.
Back to our callers. We're back connected again, and Dick joins us next in Oakland. Dick, go ahead.
Hi, this is Dick, and I bought a house 20 years ago in Oakland, just south of the Berkeley border, and it found out that it had been a speakeasy and whorehouse run by the son of the mayor of Berkeley, who was protected as a courtesy by the Oakland police, courtesy to the Berkeley mayor.
That's when Berkeley was a good town.
Uh-huh. And I must note that prohibition, whether it's booze or grass or crack, gives lots of opportunity for corruption and graft.
Dick, thanks. Thanks for the call and the observation. We'll move on back to the wine country, to Robin, who joins us next in St. Helena. Go ahead, Robin.
Hi. We just had a nice panel discussion at our library this past week, and one of the things they were doing, because they couldn't ship wine, the wineries couldn't ship wine, they were pressing grapes into bricks and shipping them back east with packets of yeast and instructions saying, do not add yeast to this or alcoholic beverages will ensue.
No end to people's ingenuity, Robin.
I don't know if anybody heard about anything like that.
Yeah, great, great story. Anyone know of that particular technique?
That's a new one.
All right. Well, Robin, thank you. It shows that the libraries have something to provide us in this discussion of what prohibition was like. We're going to move on now to Dina, who joins us from the state of Iowa. Go ahead, Dina.
Hi. My question is, I've heard a lot about the East Coast and the West Coast of having breweries and such, but I haven't heard a lot about Kansas and the Midwest. I actually married into a family that had a history of bootlegging in the prohibition, and I just haven't heard that much about the Midwest, and I know that they were big in selling whiskey to Chicago, and I just wanted to know what your thoughts or rumors were of that era.
All right. Thanks, Dina. Anyone know Midwestern productivity in that era?
Of course, Chicago was extraordinary, but also all those towns, Detroit, Milwaukee, St. Louis, all had big, again, gangster-driven or controlled prohibition busters.
Yeah, much bigger in San Francisco.
Yeah, yeah.
Just have a minute and a half left, so I want to go around. Each of you tell me what you're going to do today, hopefully legally, that will commemorate the 75th anniversary of the end of prohibition. James Smith.
Well, I'm just going to tip a bit of Jack to prohibition and just be thankful it's gone.
Charles Fracchia.
Go home and have a glass of wine.
Just any wine? You have something in particular picked out for this occasion?
For a variety of reasons. My wife and I are doing some champagne tonight.
All right. And Dick Boyd.
I'm going to have a shooter of probably a Powers Irish at Caesar's Cafe for lunch with an old buddy.
All right, that sounds perfect. And Warren Hinkle, what you're going to do, but what you'd recommend people do on this 75th anniversary.
I don't know if I recommend this, but I'm going to maliciously pour a bottle of non-alcoholic wine down the toilet.
You know, that's about as good a close as I could ever come up with, so we'll leave it there. Warren Hinkle, who is the publisher of Argonaut Magazine and a longtime San Francisco writer, thanks for being part of our program today. Dick Boyd joined us as well. He's the author of Broadway North Beach, The Golden Years, A Saloon Keeper's Tale. Dick, thanks for being part of our program. Also, thanks to James Smith, author of San Francisco's Lost Landmarks. James, thanks. And Charles Fracchia, the founder and president emeritus of the San Francisco Museum and Historical Society, author of Fire and Gold, The San Francisco Story. Charles, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Thanks to our listeners and emailers as well for contributing their thoughts on that time in San Francisco's history. Coming up on Monday on Forum, we're going to be talking with Calvin Trillin. Michael will be interviewing the famous poet and writer on Monday morning. That's 10 o'clock. Michael's guest in the second hour of Forum. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer, Danny Bringer. The executive producer of Forum is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson. Happy 75th anniversary of the end of Prohibition, everyone. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.